Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So I'm not a cradle Catholic, but as you know, I'm a cradle astronomer. From my earliest childhood, I was fascinated by the heavens. As I talked about, you couldn't see the heavens from New York City. It was simply too bright. And so the Hayden Planetarium was, for me, a kind of a, I didn't realize it at the time, but a sort of a secular temple. You would go into this enormous rotunda. You would sit in these seats. This creature would rise from a central pit commanded by an astronomer who was controlling all of it in a console. I'm sure it had sort of the flavor of an ancient Roman pagan rite in a large temple. Then the lights would darken, the room would darken, and the projector with its myriad lenses would project the stars on the inner dome, and so the universe would come to life. That really kind of made an impression on me, this sort of visceral experience of the universe. And I think in many ways it, although it's not the reason I became a Catholic, the fact that we have such a physical kind of faith in our liturgies, that appeals to me certainly as well. But I was not raised Catholic. I was raised Jewish. Judaism was my family's religion. And as was common in the 1960s, particularly on the East Coast, it was normal for Jewish families to purchase as their family Bible a King James Bible, with, of course, both the Old and New Testaments, although with many of the books that we as Catholics read put in the middle in the Apocrypha or not even there at all. The reason that was so popular was that it was beautifully done as a Bible. It was there were beautiful color plates. It was bound beautifully. The pages had color ornamentation on them. And in fact, I still own that Bible, and so that will be making a cameo appearance at the very end of this talk in one of the slides. And I did have some religious training. I went to a Reformed synagogue in Manhattan, New York City, Central Synagogue. It's beautiful Moorish architecture. It was the oldest Reformed synagogue in, I think, in the United States, actually. And so at the time, there was you could roughly divide Judaism into Orthodox Judaism, which was very, very strict, very observant. Some Orthodox Jewish sects wear special clothing and so on. Reformed Judaism, which some called somewhat pejoratively Judaism light, and then there was conservative Judaism, which is what actually most American Jews are these days. So we joined the synagogue for several years, but at the same time, at home, in my spare time, I was reading the King James Bible, both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And these beautiful color plates that depicted key moments in the salvation history of humankind were very enticing and attractive to me. They were reproductions of some famous paintings over the centuries. The ones, especially the color plates that depicted the passion, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ in particular, were very alluring to me. But they're also very disturbing. And despite the fact that I tried to read the New Testament, I really just didn't understand any of it. I didn't really get it. Those were very difficult times. My father, as I said last night, died when I was 14 after a long struggle with alcoholism and pill abuse. My mother had been a precision tap dancer, a Rockette at Radio City Music Hall. How many people know what the Rockettes are? Okay, great. So she did that before she was married, and then when my father lost his business, my mother and father divorced, and then he passed away, she went back to the music hall to dance. So it was a very difficult time. My sister and I were alone a lot of the time. New York City was a really crime-ridden, bankrupt, seedy city. It was not a fun place to be. In fact, I got robbed on the street a few times. And so life just felt really dark and really filled with anxiety. And then the surprise happened, which was that in a dream, I was in some sort of a church, a cathedral. I could hear organ music. It was very dark, actually, and I was sort of up on a sort of a side choir loft or something. And I felt a presence behind me. And I turned around, and even though there was no face, I knew that presence was Jesus Christ. And I felt this tremendous love and this tremendous unburdening of all of this anxiety and darkness. And at the end of the dream, I actually felt myself being carried by Jesus, floating out of the church into the sunlight. I didn't know what to do with that dream. It felt strikingly real. I remained a Jew. I told my mother about the dream. She said, well, do you need any more hint than that? Because she was considering converting. She sort of became a Christian very late in life, but not really in any definitive way. But I remained a Jew. I didn't act on that dream for many years, in fact, for decades. Now, I just want to make sure everyone understands I'm not claiming that I had a private revelation, a supernatural revelation. In fact, I puzzled over that dream. Was it psychological? Was it real? What was it? And actually, Father Cuddy here, when I was here as a visiting scholar, we sat down, I talked about it, and he gave me a very, very useful, counseling about that dream, I guess would be the right way to put it, which I'm happy to talk about in the discussion session, but I will leave it at that for now. So meanwhile, my passion for astronomy continued. I talked about all of that last night, about Carl Sagan, about Frank Drake, about my education. And then after I finished my PhD in 1985, I arrived in Tucson. During that time, as a graduate student, I'd been going with some friends to High Holy Day services at synagogues in Los Angeles. But I met my wife, Cynthia, who herself had my wife-to-be, Cynthia, about a year after I got to Tucson. She had left her family's fundamentalist Christian faith. She was born and raised in rural New Mexico and had sort of thrown the whole thing over. And she was just joining a very non-traditional Methodist church in Tucson called St. Francis in the Foothills. And I had actually gone, coincidentally, to a wedding there of another friend, and I was impressed with it. So as we began dating, we also began attending that church together, and we were actually married there in 1987. I was not baptized in that church. Unlike a traditional Methodist church where to become a member, you more or less recite the Apostles' Creed, that was not required. So it was very non-traditional and very non-committal. We did have our son baptized there when he was an infant. That church was led by a brilliant pastor by the name of David Wilkinson, who's now long retired. But unlike a lot of Methodist churches, he was very intellectual and very deep in his sermons. Now, I'm not saying other churches that's not true, but the particularly interesting thing about David Wilkinson was he was steeped in the church fathers, incorporated them a lot into his sermons, and also Teilhard de Chardin, who is an interesting and controversial figure in the Catholic Church. Somewhat now his reputation's improved through Pope Benedict's admiration of him. But it was very instructive. His sermons were very instructive, very inspiring. He could give very deep sermon on Augustine, for example, one week. Another week, I think it was probably the Feast of St. Francis, Pastor David showed up in a faux Franciscan outfit and a guitar and did Brother, Sun, Sister, Moon for us from the movie. It's a very old movie. But he was very inspiring. So that kind of got the wheels of thought going in my head. I also in Tucson came to know the Jesuit fathers and brothers of the Vatican Astronomy Group. Now, you may not know this, but the Vatican has its own observatory, and it dates back in a formal sense to the mid-19th century. And in terms of tradition, it actually dates back to the Pope Gregory's instigation of a change in the calendar from the Julian calendar to what became known as the Gregorian calendar. And he commissioned a committee which was led by a Jesuit mathematician, Christopher Clavius, and that was sort of the start of that astronomical tradition, which predates Galileo. So these Jesuits, who had their headquarters in Castel Gandolfo in Rome, but also had a Western headquarters at the University of Arizona, which is where I was teaching, because they were building a telescope there, lived lives of faith and science that made a huge impression on me. I had no idea that there were scientists who were also, in this case, Catholic priests or Catholic brothers, and that they could live these two aspects of their lives in a very harmonious way. That made a huge impression on me. The director of the observatory became a good friend of myself and of my wife, Cynthia. We did sabbaticals in Italy, where we visited the churches, many churches, great churches, little churches. We were mostly in Rome. There's a church around every corner. And so we would occasionally be there during a mass. That also made a big impression on me. Still, I identified as a Jew. And I would say, going back again to my time in college, I was never quite comfortable with not admitting what actually was the case, that I really was a Christian. I remember in college, a friend of mine who was in the dorm across the way was trying to tell me that Jesus wasn't really a historical figure, that he didn't really exist. And he said this with such tremendous confidence, and I felt very uncomfortable with that. It just seemed to go exactly the wrong way in my head. So gradually over the years, my stubborn heart was moved. And one late summer morning, sitting in my living room in Arizona after a year sabbatical in Rome, I just realized that it was time to stop running from what I actually believed in my heart, to stop running from the one who comforted me 33 years earlier in that dream, and to admit that I was a Christian, that not only did I believe that God existed, that was never in doubt, but that God is triune, that Jesus Christ is the incarnated incarnation of the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God. He was born of the Virgin Mary. And so I called up my friend, our son's pediatrician, who is a devout Catholic, and I told him about this, and he agreed to be my sponsor. I joined the RCIA program in the fall of 2006, and then on Holy Saturday in April in 2007, I was baptized and confirmed into the Catholic faith at the Newman Center of the University of Arizona. And yes, I am being fully immersed, as were all the others who are being baptized, and that is a Catholic priest. And if you want to know why he did full immersion baptism, you can ask me afterwards. That'll be an easy question. And he's a Dominican, too, so Western Dominican, Father Bartholomew Hutcherson. So that was a huge change in my life, just to be able, within myself, to admit what I really believed, in spite of the fact that it was difficult for some of our friends to accept what I had done, which was to become a Catholic Christian. It was just a huge weight off of my shoulders. But I didn't do much in terms of actively being a Catholic for several years after that in 2007. It would take would take almost, I would say, almost 10 years before I began to really be out about my faith. And I'll get back to that in a little bit. But I want to move now from my personal story to this question of the conflict between science and faith. This is an enduring theme in our American society, as you all well know. Most books and websites on this topic would lead you to believe that this conflict has already been won. And does anyone want to guess which side? They would say, one, science. But it's very important to recognize that there's a strong geographic and cultural bias at work. There's a 2019 book by Elaine Eklund, a social scientist, and her colleagues entitled Secularity and Science, What Scientists Around the World Really Think About Religion. And she and her colleagues conducted enormous numbers of interviews and surveys and found that this perceived conflict is really a Western phenomenon, a peculiarly Western phenomenon. If you go to Asia or Africa, or even South America, which is Western, you don't see that. And it's particularly an American perception. You don't see it in quite the same way in Europe, for example, that there is this conflict. Even though Europe is a mostly secular society now, the idea that somehow there has to be a head-on conflict between science and faith doesn't have the same kind of high profile that it does here in the U.S. And so put simply, the science-faith conflict is in large measure another example of American exceptionalism. So why should this be the case? Well, the authors of that book see the conflict narrative as being driven mostly by two factors. First, the history of the very public battles about the teaching of evolution, which were, although Darwin was British, those conflicts occurred mostly in the United States, almost exclusively in the United States. And secondly, the tendency among scientists to equate religious faith, in particular Christian faith, with evangelical Christianity and its very literalist biblical tradition, well, that also is a mostly American phenomenon, very American. And so those two things together give this conflict a very American flavor. In fact, the idea that there's a war between science and the Christian faith began here in the U.S. in the late 19th century with two very influential books, one written by a scientist named John Draper and the other by a historian named Andrew Dixon White, who wrote his book in the very late 19th century and Draper in the mid-19th century. So Andrew Dixon White is not only a historian, or was a historian, and former U.S. ambassador to Germany, but he also was the founding president of Cornell University, where I taught for 13 years. So you can go out and visit his statue on the Arts Quad if you like. Although mostly forgotten now, both books were foundationally important sources for this narrative, and they influenced afterwards, long after these books were published and out of print, this narrative that religious authority had throughout the time of the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, as we call it, that they had oppressed science during this whole time. And that is what you hear typically from casual scientists who want to talk about the history of science, even from some historians who haven't studied it. It's very hard to get that narrative out of our psyche and out of, in particular, the internet. But if you read White's book, which is the much longer of the two books, you find that although there are some interesting points made, much of the material and depictions of the personalities are greatly simplified, exaggerated, and caricatured. The trial of Galileo is a notable example. You don't get to learn any of the complex political underpinnings and personality disputes of the Galileo affair, nor of the background associated with the Counter-Reformation within which this trial was played. The legacy of the whole conflict narrative for decades after that is that students never learned that Darwin only gave us half of the theory of evolution, natural selection, and the other half was developed by a Catholic monk, the biological mechanism by which traits are inherited. Students don't get to learn that the Big Bang was invented by a Catholic priest, as you heard this morning from Professor Oberg. But not only did Georges Lemaître actually come up with and publish that model, he also deduced out of his solutions to the equations of general relativity, he deduced and published Hubble's famous law about the relationship between the distance and the recession velocity of galaxies 2 years before Edwin Hubble did. Why is it called Hubble's law then? They don't get to learn that one of the most popular high school and college textbooks in biology, which teaches that evolution is fundamental to an understanding of biology, is co-authored by a practicing Catholic, Kenneth Miller, or that another practicing Catholic, Juan Maldacena, wrote one of the most widely cited late 20th century papers in physics on the holographic universe, which has over 25,000 citations. And if you look up Stephen Hawking's most cited paper, it only has 13,000 citations. Instead, most people associate science with Richard Dawkins, Stephen Hawking, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Brian Greene, prolific writers of popular books in which atheism is touted explicitly or implicitly as the only self-consistent view. Sorry, I have to tell my computer to not do that. Touted as the only self-consistent view that one can adopt if one is a scientist. In fact, in 2012, Austin Hughes wrote in the journal New Atlantis that there's a growing tendency to treat as scientific anything that scientists say or believe, regardless of whether it's scientific or not. So how does that work? Well, let's do a thought experiment. Imagine an impressionable undergraduate student who was brought up in Catholic faith, let's say, picks up a book by Stephen Hawking and his physicist colleague Leonard Mlodinow entitled The Grand Design, which was published in 2010. And that student then reads in the preface to that book the following. What is the nature of reality? Where did all this come from? Did the universe need a creator? Traditionally, these are questions for philosophy, but philosophy is dead. Scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. That was written by the two authors. So then that student, having read that, might go on to find an NBC website where an article describes why Hawking was sure that God does not exist. Hawking is quoted as saying that because the universe began as a singularity, time itself could not have existed before the Big Bang. Hawking then pivots from being a scientist to a philosopher and opines the following. We have finally found something that doesn't have a cause because there was no time for a cause to exist in. For me, this means there is no possibility of a creator because there's no time for a creator to have existed in. Now, obviously, this argument assumes that the creator of the cosmos is a being who must exist in time, whereas St. Thomas teaches us, as did Augustine before him, that God is not a being, God is being. God's essence is his existence, and that God is transcendent of the universe, including of time. But since, as Hughes wrote, we tend to believe scientists, even when they aren't talking science, our imaginary or hypothetical student, who maybe has not been to one of these retreats, might simply accept uncritically Hawking's argument for the non-existence of God and thereby lose his or her faith. Unless you think that this is a very hypothetical argument, I've talked to parents of students who have lost their faith in very much the same way. So, despite claims by popular science writers the contrary, science cannot be used to prove or to disprove the existence of God. Nor can science prove or disprove that God is triune, or that the second person of the Trinity became flesh and dwelt among us, or any of the core tenets of our faith. To think otherwise is to misunderstand both the limitations of science, which is concerned with understanding observing, testing the physical material universe of which we are a part. To think otherwise is to misunderstand that, the limitations of science, and is to misunderstand at least what we as Catholics believe about God, and I would argue the same for our Jewish brothers and sisters, our Muslim brothers and sisters, other Christians, many other faiths. For scientists themselves to assert otherwise is to abuse the privilege we enjoy of being among the most trusted of professions, and many scientists use that advantage to try to push their own ideas, usually atheistic ideas, which are generally ill thought out, poorly conceived, and yet very, very influential. Now, I want to do about a 5-minute interlude here on evolution, because Professor Oberg talked about cosmology. And I want to talk about contributions that Catholic scientists in particular has made about evolution, and I also want to talk about how St. Thomas can help us to understand the theory of Darwinian evolution as Catholics. So I'm going to show a few slides on this. So biological evolution is... just do that. There we go. Biological evolution is the process of the development through time of new forms of life derived from earlier forms, sometimes called descent with modification. Darwinian evolution is a particular theory of biological evolution in which all species arise and develop through the natural selection of small inherited variations that increase the, or for some individuals, decrease or kill off for some individuals, but for others, increase the individual's ability to compete, survive, and reproduce. It's called a theory in the same way that general relativity is a theory of gravity, not because it's proven, because in science you cannot prove that a particular theory or model is right, but it is elevated above a hypothesis because it's an explanation for a natural phenomenon that is very widely accepted among the scientific community, and it's supported by numerous experiments or observational tests or both. And general relativity is the most tested physical theory in modern times, and it passes every single test. And so far, biological evolution does too, in the sense that the mechanisms for it can be understood and in many ways manipulated, even though we can't go back in time over the history of the Earth. So just very briefly about genes and inheritance. Genes are the units of inheritance, and this is important when I talk about Gregor Mendel. They are the DNA, the deoxyribonucleic acid, that holds the information needed to build the proteins that make organisms what they are, that give us the structure that we are. That information is carried in the cells by another related molecule, ribonucleic acid, to the places, the ribosomes, where proteins are assembled. Protein formation occurs through transcription, where the information is taken from the DNA, put on the RNA, and translation of that information to make proteins. Both DNA and RNA, however, are formed and duplicated through the mediation of proteins. Without proteins, that can't happen. And so there's this chicken and egg problem, that DNA and RNA direct the formation of proteins, but the proteins themselves are needed to make DNA and RNA. And that's the central paradigm of biology, and it's why the origin of life is such a very, very difficult problem. The persistence of cellular life through geologic time depends on the ability of the code in DNA to be very accurately replicated and transcribed, and that requires proteins. Mutations are changes in that code. They're copying errors induced by radiation, by chemicals, by duplication. Most mutations don't matter. They're inconsequential because much of the DNA, actually much of the segments of DNA, are actually not expressed. They're non-coding. And if the mutations happen there in the cells, nothing changes. But some mutations are expressed. They occur on the parts of the DNA that are expressed as genes. And that most of the time leads to cellular death. But once in a while, it leads to an increased chance of survival and procreation, particularly if organisms are in a changing environment where those changes confer some advantage on those altered organisms. So that's the theory. And where people sometimes have difficulty with this is the idea that how can a random process lead to something like human beings? Where is God in a random process? What does it mean if we arise through biological evolution, through our physical bodies arise that way? Where is God in that? And so there's actually quite a lot of helpful guidance from St. Thomas on this. But before I give you some of those quotes, I want to give you a couple of quotes from two popes on evolution. Actually, the discussion of evolution goes back at least to Humani Generis in the middle 20th century, where that encyclical says that evolution might be true. We don't know. By the time of John Paul II, he's much more definitive. He says that some new findings lead us toward the recognition of evolution as more than a hypothesis. And then he goes on to say theories of evolution, which because the philosophies which inspire them regard the spirit either as emerging from the forces of living matter or as simple epiphenomena of that matter, are incompatible with the truth about man. So at once Pope John Paul II, who wrote the famous Faith and Reason, says that from a physical biological point of view, there is certainly evidence for evolution, but evolution is not the whole story in what human beings are and our relationship to the divine. Certainly, it doesn't tell us anything about that. Pope Benedict XVI went a little bit farther and said that currently there's a fierce debate raging between so-called creationism and evolutionism, presented as though they were mutually exclusive. This antithesis is absurd because on the one hand, there's so many scientific proofs in favor of evolution, which appears to be a reality we can see and which enriches our knowledge of life and being as such. But on the other hand, that doctrine does not answer every query. So guidance from encyclicals and speeches by popes and so on should give us some assurance that the theory of evolution is not incompatible with church teaching. But one can go even farther than that. One can look at what St. Thomas had to say and understand that in many ways, what is central to the theory of evolution makes an enormous amount of sense as well in terms of the omnipotence of God and God's providence. So I'll give you three examples. One is, does randomness in evolution cause a problem for the omnipotence of God? We think that randomness is something that's uncontrolled or is chaotic or lawless. That's actually not what physicists mean when they talk about random. When they talk about random, they really mean that a given event is not correlated with preceding events that you can measure. It still obeys physical laws. For example, the process of radioactive decay is random with respect to an individual atom. You can't look at an individual radioactive isotope and say that one's going to decay to a different isotope in 15 minutes. But if you have a large collection of these atoms, you can tell very accurately when half of them are going to decay. There's something called the half-life, which can be accurately measured. And so the half-life is measurable, and so the behavior of large numbers of those atoms is very predictable. And so if we think of these processes in the way the language that St. Thomas uses is contingent rather than random, that's probably a better term for them. St. Thomas had no problem with divine providence involving both random and what he called necessary events. And in fact, he says, and this is in your sheet, by the way, there's a quote by Augustine on time, which I included there, which is intended to go with the discussion of Stephen Hawking. But if you then go to, I think, page 2, or they're a little out of order, you'll see some of these quotes. So on contingency and divine providence, Aquinas says, divine providence imposes necessity upon some things, not upon all, as some formerly believed. For to providence it belongs to order things towards an end. Now, after the divine goodness, which is an extrinsic end to all things, the principal good in things themselves is the perfection of the universe, which would not be were not all grades of being found in things. And therefore, he says, it pertains to divine providence to produce every grade of being, and so it has prepared for some things necessary causes, so that they happen of necessity, for others contingent causes, that they may happen by contingency according to the nature of their proximate causes. So Aquinas recognizes that there are two kinds of causes, one we would think of as random, and that divine providence is behind both of them. And in fact, Father Thomas Davenport, who is a Dominican physicist and philosopher and went to the same school that we did, Caltech, says that while this type of knowledge, the knowledge of contingent events, seems to go against our very understanding of what knowledge and causation are, that's only because we are familiar with how created causes know and work. That means anything that is material in our universe, ourselves, baseball bats, radioactive decay, etc. But God is not another part of nature. He is not even the greatest part of nature. Rather, he is nature's author and sustainer. He is the creator totally other to the created universe. And therefore, even though we can't understand how contingent events or random events could be known in a timeless way, that's exactly what God does. Okay. Three. Okay, that should be labeled two. Now, in creating all this diversity, all these forms that have gone extinct in the past that no longer exist today, many that are not even in the fossil record, is evolution an argument against divine wisdom if there's this sort of profligate creation of these forms? Actually, evolution is an argument for divine wisdom. And again, Aquinas says, the multiplicity and distinction existing among things were devised by the divine intellect and established in things so that the divine goodness might be represented by created things in various ways, and that different things might participate in the divine goodness in varying degree. All this was so that a certain beauty might shine forth from the very order existing among diverse things, a beauty which would direct the mind to the divine wisdom. So from St. Thomas's point of view, diversity and order and beauty go together, and they're all coming from the divine wisdom. And so we should expect an earth that has many, many, many more different kinds of life forms than we can see today. They can't all exist in the same ecosystems. That wouldn't make any sense. And likewise, we should expect from what St. Thomas says that we should see life forms in other worlds where the environment is habitable. This is not a whale. This is an imaginative sea creature in the ocean of Europa. That would be perfectly consistent with what St. Thomas had to say. And finally, evolution does not negate that all existence is radically dependent on God, nor that God works through secondary causes, because the mechanisms of evolution are the secondary or instrumental causes that are part of the physical evolution of the universe, this unfolding of a universe that, as Professor Oberg said, began with almost a ridiculously large amount of order compared to what it otherwise could have. Expressed through the thermodynamic concept of entropy, the universe, the early universe, began with an absurdly low value for the entropy relative to what it could have. And again, St. Thomas says that as to the design of government, God governs all things immediately, whereas in its execution, its evolution, he governs some things by means of others. Now, am I supposed to end at 10 of or a quarter of, Father?
Either one is fine.
I'll do 10 of. I'll do 10 of. 10 of will be fine. Okay. Now, I hope I've convinced you that St. Thomas has a lot to tell us about evolution, biological evolution, even though he lived in a time when this was not understood from a scientific point of view. But he would have been very comfortable with it, I think. Another Catholic, faithful Catholic, the Augustinian monk Gregor Mendel, actually did do something about evolution. And I want to now briefly go through that. So Darwinian evolution, as I said, consists of two things, natural selection and mutation. The two things have to go together. It is sometimes presumed that Darwin figured out both, but actually Darwin did not. When he published The Origin of Species and he described natural selection, the book was criticized because it lacked a theory of how these traits were actually inherited. There was no, what was described in that book was actually nothing. There was no description of how these traits that are selected upon by the environment are actually inherited. So some years later, Darwin published a theory of inheritance that turned out to be completely incorrect. It was called pangenesis, and the idea was all the cells in the body contribute to the traits of the offspring by donating to the sex cells some sort of material. And the way that this was described, you would have a situation where if one of your parents had blue eyes and the other had brown eyes, you would have sort of a mixture of blue and brown. And so all traits would get washed out over just a few generations. In 1863, Gregor Mendel, having obtained a copy on The Origin of Species, was conducting his famous experiments on pea plants. And he came up with a theory of inheritance that is essentially the modern theory today. Now, we think of Mendel as having developed the laws of heredity, which come from his famous pea plant experiments, that if you have a white, let's say, a plant which has white flowers and a plant which has red flowers, and you cross them together, if red is the dominant trait and white is the recessive trait, all of the next generation will have red flowers. Then if you cross again with a red and white and red and white in the next generation, you will see the actually, if you cross these with each other, I should say, the recessive trait can appear in one out of every four of the next generation. So how does this happen? It happens because traits are discrete in the sex cells and the gametes, each offspring gets half of the chromosomes from the father, half from the mother. They're resorted, and the dominant traits appear. What Mendel did was more than provide the laws of heredity. He actually described in a paper in German, he described the physical mechanisms. He didn't know that DNA existed. That would be a century later. He didn't have the details of the cell, but he described mechanistically how this inheritance actually occurs. And that turned out to be completely forgotten, that part of his paper. In fact, he sent this paper to Darwin, and it was found after Darwin's death, still unopened in the original mailing envelope. And because it was in German, many American scientists didn't read this, and evolution was considered to have a profound weakness because the theory of inheritance was not outlined until in the early 20th century, two American scientists proposed the same theory. And actually, by then, Mendel's paper was translated, and they acknowledged it, and they were aware of it. So that by 2022, a special issue on Mendel, a scientist historian could say the following. Today, the Darwin-Mendel marriage is the foundation of evolutionary biology. Mendel's contribution was not, as it is sometimes characterized, the missing jigsaw puzzle in a complex, sprawling, Darwin-dominated scientific puzzle. Rather, a better analogy is a lock and key, where each of the two contributions is equally critical to the whole. And so one can easily make the remarkable statement that really Darwinian evolution is Darwinian-Mendelian evolution, that Darwin contributed the natural selection and Mendel the theory of the inheritance of traits, which was later confirmed. So that really, if you think about the two most profound 20th century revolutions in our understanding of the world, the origin of the universe and Darwinian evolution, in each case, Catholic scientists, in fact, Catholic religious, were at the core of those revolutions. And that is something that we do not learn in school. So I'm going to wrap up. It's not until we get into our 50s that we come to realize, according to the social scientist Ronald Dworkin, that the spiritual food that science offers would not suit even a canary. I was 47 when I arrived at that point, even though I remain as passionate about science today as when I was young. But it's not what sustains me as a human person. And well before they reach that age, droves of young people are leaving our church and becoming part of the growing mass of the nuns. Most will not come back. And I think this is a trend that should trouble all of us. Are young people today, by and large, happier than the previous generation for being secular? I would say no. So for the sake of our country and our young people, sorry, I'm talking to you as young people, we have to put the conflict narrative to bed once and for all. One way to do that comes from the Eklund book, 2019 book. They found that working closely with a religious scientist who has developed a successful career seems to illustrate to a non-religious scientist that science and religion do not conflict with each other. And they call, Eklund and colleagues, call such scientists boundary pioneers. And they say that they provide a public example of how science and religion can be compatible. If a great number of well-respected scientists were to discuss how they reconcile their faith and work, we predict prejudice against religious scientists would decrease. And that's why in 2016, six professors of science who are Catholic, including myself and Professor Oberg, founded the Society of Catholic Scientists, which is a membership organization with over 2,200 members, holds annual meetings, offers mentoring to students who may find balancing their faith and their science challenging, and has lots of activities around the country. It's one of the reasons why the Thomistic Institute exists. It's one of the reasons why at Cornell, I and a group of like-minded professors founded something called COLAS, which is a Catholic institute, an institute for Catholic culture and faith, and has now been doing pretty well for in its fifth year. But it does take courage to witness to your faith, especially in situations where the expectation is that a secular point of view is the right point of view. It takes courage to counter people who might come up to you at a party and say that, how can you believe in God? God is just a sort of an old man with a beard, a magician in the sky. You can tell them that you don't believe in that kind of God either. And maybe if there's a little bit of curiosity, you can begin to move them toward more profound thoughts. You can move them to Moses' encounter at the burning bush with God, the greatest theophany of the Hebrew scriptures, where God's self-revelation is enigmatic and mysterious. And I've included that part of Exodus in the handout there, as well as St. Thomas's exploration of this concept of God's essence as existence itself. If your friends want to obsess over inconsistencies in the two creation stories in Genesis, redirect them to a different kind of creation story in the New Testament, the prologue to the Gospel according to John, the revelation that the universe is created by and infused with the light and love and wisdom of a creator God who is transcendent to the universe and yet became flesh and dwelt among us as man. Whatever these dialogues are, you have to tailor your message to your audience, and that's a long tradition. St. Paul tailored his message to his audience. In the Acts of the Apostles, we know that when he went to Athens and encountered the Stoic philosophers, his message was very different from the message in his epistles that are directed to the churches, to the nascent churches, to Jews who were becoming Christians, to the Greeks as well. But to the skeptical Greek philosophers, he delivered a very theological message to which a natural philosopher in first century Greece would be receptive. It is he, God, who gives to everyone life and breath and everything. For in him we move and have our being, as even some of your poets have said. That was a message so very different from the one that Paul delivered in the synagogues and the early churches. Paul knew his audience very, very well. So in closing, I urge those of you pursuing a career in science to first of all embrace it. Strive to be your best. Do great science. And I also urge you to embrace your faith. open your heart to the God who loves you, and be open to those people around you who might initially feel that they can't possibly believe what you believe in. But by opening your heart, their hearts may open too. You can do both. You can do great science and embrace your faith. And you will live a happier and more fulfilling life for doing so. And for those times when you feel vulnerable because of your faith, when you feel that you're standing like St. Paul at the Areopagus in Athens in front of a formidable crowd of Stoic philosophers, remember that you're never alone. It is Jesus Christ himself who, in exhorting us to go out and spread the good news, also reassures us, "Behold, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.